When he came to his senses, Max snorted and pulled away involuntarily from the odious smell. He blinked and blearily made out a mustachioed neo-chimp holding a broken snap capsule in his hand. From it, still emitted noxious fumes.
"Ah, awake again, I see."
Max felt miserable. Of course, he ached all over from the stunning, and could barely move. But also his arms and wrists seemed to be burning. They were tied behind him, but he could guess they were probably broken.
Where am I? He asked. You're at the focus of a hyperspace shunt,
Iron Grip told him matter-of-factly. Max spat.
You're a good all-damn liar.
Have it your way,
Iron Grip shrugged.
I just figured you deserved an explanation. You see, this machine is a special kind of shunt, what's called an amplifier. It's supposed to take images out of a brain and make them clear for all to see. During the ceremony, it'll be under Institute control. But their representatives haven't arrived yet, so today we're going to overload it just a bit as a test. Normally, the subject's supposed to be cooperative, and the process is benign. Today, though, well, it just isn't going to matter that much.
A sharp chirping complaint came from behind Iron Grip. Through a narrow hatch could be seen the technicians of the suzerain of Cost and Caution.
Time, the lead Quacku snapped. Quickly, make haste.
Much or hurry, Max asked. Afraid some of the other Goobru factions may have heard the commotion and be on their way? Iron Grip looked up from closing the hatch. He shrugged.
All that means is we've got time to ask just one question, but it'll serve. Just tell us about Galet.
Never.
He won't be able to help it, Iron Grip laughed. Ever try not to think about something? You won't be able to avoid thoughts about her. And once it's got something to get a grip on, the machine will rip the rest out of you.
You,
Max struggled for words, but this time they were gone. He writhed, trying to move out of the focus of the massive coiled tubes aimed at him from all sides. But his strength was gone. There was nothing he could do. Except not think of Galet Jones. But by trying not to, of course, he was thinking about her. Max moaned, even as the machines began giving out a low hum in superficial accompaniment. All at once he felt as if the gravitic fields of 100 starships were playing up and down his skin. And in his mind, 1,000 images whirled. More and more of them pictured his former employer and friend.
No!
Max struggled for an idea. He mustn't try not to think of something. What he had to do was find something else to contemplate. He had to find something new to focus his attention on during the remaining seconds before he was torn apart.
Of course. He let the enemy be his guide.
For weeks they had questioned him, asking only about Garthlings. Garthlings, nothing but Garthlings. It had become something of a chant. For him, it now became a mantra.
Where are the presentients?
They had insisted. Max concentrated, and in spite of the pain, it just had to make him laugh.
Of all the stupid, dumb, idiotic.
Contempt for the Galactics filled him. They wanted a projection out of him? Well, let them amplify this. Outside in the mountains and forests, he knew it would be about dawn. He pictured those forests, and the closest thing he could imagine to Garthlings, and laughed at the image he had made. His last moments were spent guffawing over the idiocy of life. Chapter 72 Athaclena. The autumn storms had returned again, only this time as a great cyclonic front, rolling down the valley of the Sindh. In the mountains, the accelerated winds surged to savage gusts that sloughed the outer leaves from trees and sent them flying in tight eddies. The debris gave shape and substance to whirling devil outlines in the gray sky. As if in counterpoint, the volcano had begun to grumble as well. Its rumbling complaint was lower, slower in building than the wind, but its tremors made the forest creatures even more nervous as they huddled in their dens or tightly grasped the swaying tree trunks. Sentience was no certain protection against the gloom. Within their tents, under the mountain's shrouded flanks, the chims clung to each other and listened to the moaning zephyrs. Now and then one would give in to the tension and disappear screaming into the forest, only to return an hour or so later, disheveled and embarrassed, dragging a trail of torn foliage behind him. The gorillas also were susceptible, but they showed it in other ways. At night they stared up at the billowing clouds with a quiet, focused concentration, sniffling as if searching for something expectantly. Athaclena could not quite decide what it reminded her of that evening, but later, in her own tent under the dense forest canopy, she could easily hear their low, atonal singing as they answered the storm. It was a lullaby that eased her into sleep, but not without a price. Expectancy. Such a song would, of course, beckon back that which had never completely gone away. Athaclena's head tossed back and forth on her pillow. Her tendrils waved, seeking, repelled, probing, compelled. Gradually, as if in no particular hurry, the familiar essence gathered.
Tutsunukan,
she breathed, unable to awaken or avoid the inevitable. It formed overhead, fashioned out of that which was not.
Tutsunukan, Saha Brunitsun, Atwilith.
A Timbrumi knew better than to ask for mercy, especially from Ifni's universe. But Athaclena had changed into something that was both more and less than mere Timbrumi. Tutsunukan had allies now. It was joined by visual images, metaphors. Its aura of threat was amplified, made almost palpable, filled out by the added substance of human-style nightmare.
Sa, Brunitsun.
She sighed, pleading antiphaltically in her sleep. Night winds blew the flaps of her tent, and her dreaming mind fashioned the wings of huge birds. Malevolent, they flew just over the treetops, their gleaming eyes searching, searching. A faint volcanic trembling shook the ground beneath her bedroll, and Athaclena shivered in syncopation, imagining burrowing creatures, the dead, the unavenged, wasted potential of this world, ruined and destroyed by the Burrali so long ago. They squirmed just underneath the disturbed ground, seeking...
Sa, Brunitsun, Tutsunukan.
The brush of her own waving tendrils felt like the webs and feet of tiny spiders. Gear flux sent tiny gnomes wriggling under her skin, busy fashioning unwilled changes. Athaclena moaned as the glyph of terrible expectant laughter hovered nearer and regarded her, bent over her. Reached down.
General? Ms. Athaclena? Excuse me, ma'am, are you awake? I'm sorry to disturb you, Sarah, but...
The chim stopped. He had pulled aside the tent flap to enter, but now he rocked back in dismay as Athaclena sat up suddenly, eyes wide apart, cat-like irises dilated, her lips curled back in a rictus of somnolent fear. She did not appear to be aware of him. He blinked, staring at the pulsations that coursed slowly, like soliton waves, down her throat and shoulders. Above her agitated tendrils, he briefly glimpsed something terrible. He almost fled right then. It took a powerful effort of courage to swallow instead, to bear down and to choke forth words.
Ma'am, please, it's me, Sammy.
Slowly, as if drawn back by the sheerest force of will, the light of awareness returned to those gold-flecked eyes. They closed, reopened. With a tremulous sigh, Athaclena shuddered. Then she collapsed forward. Sammy stood there, holding her while she sobbed. At that moment, stunned and frightened and astonished, all he could think of was how light and frail she felt in his arms.
That was when Galet became convinced that any trick, if the ceremony was a trick at all, had to be a subtle one. You see, the suzerain of propriety seems to have done a complete about-face regarding Chim Uplift. It had started out convinced it would find evidence of mismanagement, and perhaps even cause to take neo-chimps away from humans. But now the suzerain seemed to be earnest in searching out appropriate race representatives.
The voice of Fibbon Bolger came from a small playback unit resting on the rough-hewn logs of Athaclena's table. She listened to the recording Robert had sent. The Chim's report back at the caves had had its amusing moments. Fibbon's irrepressible good nature and dry wit had helped lift Athaclena's limp spirits. Now, though, while relating Dr. Galet Jones's ideas about Gubru intentions, his voice had dropped, and he sounded reticent, almost embarrassed. Athaclena could feel Fibbon's discomfort through the vibrations in the air. Sometimes one did not need another's presence in order to sense their essence. She smiled at the irony.
He is starting to know who and what he is, and it frightens him.
Athaclena sympathized. A sane being wished for peace and serenity, not to be the mortar in which the ingredients of destiny are finely ground. In her hand, she held the locket containing her mother's legacy thread, and her father's. For the moment, at least, Tutsunokan was held at bay. But Athaclena knew somehow that the glyph had returned for good. There would be no sleep now, no rest, until Tutsunokan changed into something else. Such a glyph was one of the largest known manifestations of quantum mechanics, a probability amplitude that hummed and throbbed in a cloud of uncertainty, pregnant with 1,000,000,000 possibilities. Once the wave function collapsed, all that remained would be fate. Delicate political maneuverings on so many levels, among the local leaders of the invasion force, among factions back on the Gubru homeworld, between the Gubru and their enemies and possible allies, between the Gubru and Earth, and among the various galactic institutes. She stroked the locket. Sometimes one does not need another's presence in order to sense their essence. There was too much complexity here. What did Robert think he would accomplish by sending her this taping? Was she supposed to delve into some vast storehouse of sage galactic wisdom, or perform some incantation, and somehow come up with a policy to guide them through this? Through this? She sighed.
Oh, Father, how I must be a disappointment to you.
The locket seemed to vibrate under her trembling fingers. For some time it seemed that another trance was settling in, drawing her downward into despair.
By Darwin, Goodall, and Greenpeace!
It was the voice of Major Pratha Chulthorn that jarred her out of it. She listened for a while longer.
A target?
Athaklena shuddered. Oh, things were indeed quite dire. All was explained now, particularly the sudden, gravid insistence of an impatient Glyph. When the pellet ran out, she turned to her aides, Elaine Sue, Sammy, and Dr. DeShriver. The Chims watched her patiently.
"I will seek altitude now,"
she told them.
But the storm, ma'am, we aren't sure it's past. And then there's the volcano. We've been talking about an evacuation."
Athaklena stood up.
"I do not expect to be long. Please send nobody along to guard or look out for me. They will only disturb me and make more difficult what I must do."
She stopped at the flap of the tent then, feeling the wind push at the fabric, as if searching for some gap at which to pry.
"Be patient. I am coming."
When she spoke to the Chims again, it was in a low voice.
"Please have horses ready for when I return."
The flap dropped after her. The Chims looked at each other, then silently went about preparing for the day. Mount Fosse steamed in places where the vapor could not be entirely attributed to rising dew. Moist droplets still fell from leaves that shivered in the wind, now waning, but still returning now and then in sudden, violent gusts. Athaklena climbed doggedly up a narrow game trail. She could tell that her wishes were being respected. The Chims remained behind, leaving her undisturbed. The day was beginning with low clouds cutting through the peaks like the vanguards of some aerial invasion. Between them she could see patches of dark blue sky. A human's eyesight might even have picked out a few stubborn stars. Athaklena climbed for height, but even more for solitude. In the upper reaches the animal life of the forest was even sparser. She sought emptiness. At one point, the trail was clogged with debris from the storm, sheets of some cloth-like material that she soon recognized.
Plate ivy parachutes.
They reminded her. Down in the camp, the Chimteks had been striving to meet a strict timetable, developing variations on gorilla gut bacteria in time to meet nature's deadline. Now, though, it looked as if Major Pratha Chulthorn's schedule would not allow Robert's plan to be used.
"Such foolishness,"
Athaklena thought.
"How did humans last even this long, I wonder?"
Perhaps they had to be lucky. She had read of their 20th century, when it seemed more than Ifni's chance that helped them squeeze past near certain doom. Doom not only for themselves, but for all future sapient races that might be born of their rich, fecund world. The tale of that narrow escape was perhaps one reason why so many races feared or hated the Kuchunan, the wolflings. It was uncanny and unexplained to this day. The earthlings had a saying, "There, but for the love of God, go I." The sick, raped paucity of Garth was mild compared to what they might easily have done to Terra.
"How many of us would have done better under such circumstances?"
That was the question that underlay all the smug superior posturings and all of the contempt pouring from the great clans. For they had never been tested by the ages of ignorance mankind suffered. What might it have felt like to have no patrons, no library, no ancient wisdom, only the bright flame of mind, unchanneled and undirected, free to challenge the universe or to consume the world? The question was one few clans dared ask themselves. She brushed aside the little parachutes. Athaklena edged past the snagged cluster of early spore carriers and continued her ascent, pondering the vagaries of destiny. At last she came to a stony slope where the southern outlook gave a view of more mountains, and in the far distance, just the faintest possible colored trace of a sloping step. She breathed deeply and took out the locket her father had given her. Growing daylight did not keep away the thing that had begun to form amid her wavering tendrils. This time Athaclena did not even try to stop it. She ignored it, always the best thing to do when an observer does not yet want to collapse probability into reality. Her fingers worked the clasp, the locket opened, and she flipped back the lid.
"Your marriage was true," she thought of her parents.
For where two threads had formerly lain, now there was only one larger one, shimmering upon the velvety lining. An end curled around one of her fingers. The locket tumbled to the rocky ground and lay there forgotten as she plucked the other end out of the air. Stretched out, the tendril hummed, at first quietly, but she held it tautly in front of her, allowing the wind to stroke it, and she began to hear harmonics. Perhaps she should have eaten, should have built her strength for this thing she was about to attempt. It was something few of her race did, even once in their lifetimes. On occasions, Timbrimi had died.
"Ah, tith to Anu, with the calving,"
she breathed, and she added her mother's name.
"Ah, tith to Anine, Mathakluana."
The throbbing increased. It seemed to carry up her arms, to resonate against her heartbeat. Her own tendrils responded to the notes, and Athaclena began to sway.
"Ah, tith to Anu, with a calving."
"It's a beauty, all right, but a few more weeks' work would make it more potent. But this batch will do, and it'll be ready in time for when the ivy sheds." Dr. De Shriver put the culture back into its incubator. Their makeshift laboratory on the flanks of the mountain had been sheltered from the winds. The storm had not interfered with the experiments. Now the fruit of their labors seemed nearly ripe. Her assistant grumbled, though. "What's the use? The Gubru'd just come up with countermeasures. Anyway, the Major says the attack is going to take place before the stuff's ready to be used." The Shriver took off her glasses. "The point is that we keep working until Miss Athaclena tells us otherwise. I'm a civilian, so are you. Fibbon and Robert may have to obey the chain of command when they don't like it, but you and I can choose." Her voice trailed off when she saw that Sammy wasn't listening any longer. He stared over her shoulder. She whirled to see what he was looking at. If Athaclena had appeared strange, eerie, this morning, after her terrifying nightmare, now her features made Dr. De Shriver gasp. The disheveled alien girl blinked with eyes narrow and close together in fatigue. She clutched the tent pole as they hurried forward, but when the Chims tried to move her to a cot, she shook her head.
"No,"
she said simply.
"Take me to Robert. Take me to Robert now."
The gorillas were singing again, their low music without melody. Sammy ran out to fetch Benjamin, while De Shriver settled Athaclena into a chair. Not knowing what to do, she spent a few moments brushing leaves and dirt from the young Timbrimi's ruff. The tendrils of her corona seemed to give off a heavy, fragrant heat that she could feel with her fingers. And above them, the thing that Tutsunukan had become made the air seem to ripple even before the eyes of the befuddled Chim. Athaclena sat there, listening to the gorilla's song, and feeling for the first time as if she understood it. All, All would play their role, she now knew. The Chims would not be very happy about what was to come, but that was their problem. Everybody had problems.
Take me to Robert,
she breathed again. Chapter 73 Uther Calding. He trembled, standing there with his back to the rising sun, feeling as if he had been sucked as dry as a husk. Never before had a metaphor felt more appropriate. Uther Calding blinked, slowly returning to the world. To the dry steppe facing the looming mountains of Mulan. All at once it seemed that he was old, and the years lay heavier than ever before. Deep down, on the Nahakiri level, he felt a numbness. After all of this, there was no way to tell if Athaklena had even survived the experience of drawing so much into herself.
She must have felt great need, he thought.
For the first time, his daughter had attempted something neither of her parents could ever have prepared her for. Nor was this something one picked up in school.
You have returned, Kalt said matter-of-factly.
The Fenanin, Uther Calding's companion for so many months, leaned on a stout staff and watched him from a few meters away. They stood in the midst of a sea of brown savanna grass, their long shadows gradually shortening with the rising sun.
Did you receive a message of some sort? Kalt asked.
He had the curiosity shared by many total non-psychics about matters that must seem to him quite unnatural.
Uther
Calding moistened his lips. But how could he explain that he had not really received anything at all? No, what happened was that his daughter had taken him up on an offer he had made, in leaving both his own thread and his dead wife's in her hands. She had called in the debt that parents owe a child for bringing her, unasked, into a strange world. One should never make an offer without knowing full well what will happen if it is accepted.
Indeed, she drained me dry.
He felt as if there was nothing left. And after all that, there was still no guarantee she had even survived the experience. Or that it had left her still sane.
Shall I lie down and die, then?
Uther Calding shivered.
No, I think not quite yet. I did experience a communion of sorts,
he told Kalt.
Will the Gerbru be able to detect this thing you have done?
Uther Calding could not even craft a palang shrug.
I do not think so. Maybe.
His tendrils lay flat like human hair.
I don't know.
The Thenanin sighed, his breathing slits flapping.
I wish you would be honest with me, colleague. It pains me to be forced to believe that you are hiding things from me.
How Uther Calding had tried and tried to get Kalt to utter those words. And now he could not really bring himself to care.
What do you mean?
He asked. The Thenanin blew in exasperation.
I mean that I have begun to suspect that you know more than you are telling me about this fascinating creature I have seen traces of. I warn you, Uther Calding, I am building a device that will solve this riddle for me. You would be well served to be direct with me before I discover the truth all by myself.
Uther Calding nodded.
I understand your warning. Now, though, perhaps we had better be walking again. If the Gubru did detect what just happened, and come to investigate, we should try to be far from here before they arrive.
He owed Athaclena that much still, not to be captured before she could make use of what she had taken.
"Very well, then," Kalt said. "We shall speak of this later."
Without any great interest, more out of habit than for any other reason, Uthakalding led his companion toward the mountains, in a direction selected, again by habit, by a faint blue twinkling only his eyes could see. Chapter 74 Galet. The new planetary branch library was a beauty. Its beige highlights glistened on a site recently cleared atop Sea Bluff Park, a kilometer south of the Timbrimi Embassy. The architecture did not blend as well as the old branch had into the neo-Fullerite motif of Port Helena, but it was quite stunning nevertheless. A windowless cube, whose pastel shades contrasted well with the nearby chalky Cretaceous outcrops. Galet stepped out into a cloud of dry dust as the air car settled under the landing apron. She followed her Kwaku escort up a paved walkway toward the entrance of the towering edifice. Most of Port Helena had turned out to watch. A few weeks ago, as a huge freighter the size of a Gubru battleship cruised lazily out of a Calibius sky and lowered the structure into place. For a large part of the afternoon, the sun had been eclipsed, while technicians from the Library Institute set the Sanctuary of Knowledge firmly into place in its new home. Galet wondered if the new library would ever really benefit the citizens of Port Helena. There were landing pads on all sides, but no provision had been made for ground car or bicycle or foot access to these bluffs from the town nearby. As she passed through the ornate columned portal, Galet realized that she was probably the first Chim ever to enter the building. Inside, the vaulted ceiling cast a soft light that seemed to come from everywhere at once. A great ruddy cube dominated the center of the hall, and Galet knew at once that this was, indeed, an expensive setup. The main data store was many times larger than the old one, a few miles from here. It might even be bigger than Earth's main library, where she had done research at La Paz. But the vastness was mostly empty compared to the constant round-the-clock bustle she was used to. There were Gubru, of course, and Kwaku. They stood at study stations scattered about the broad hall. Here and there avians clustered in small groups. Galet could see their beaks move in sharp jerks, and their feet were constantly in motion as they argued. But no sound at all escaped the muffled privacy zones. In ribbons and hoods and feather dyes, she saw the colors of propriety, of accountancy, and of soldiery. For the most part, each faction kept apart in its own area. There was bristling and some ruffling of down when the follower of one suzerain passed too close to another. In one place, however, a multi-hued gaggle of fluttering Gubru displayed that some communication remained among the factions. There was much head-ducking and preening and gesturing toward floating holographic displays, all apparently as much ritualistic as based on fact and reason. As Galet hurried by, several of the hopping, chattering birds turned to stare at her. Pointing talons and beak gestures made Galet guess that they knew exactly who she was and what she was supposed to represent. She did not hesitate or linger. Galet's cheeks felt warm.
"Is there any way I can be of service to you, miss?"
At first, Galet thought that what stood at the dais directly beneath the rayed spiral of the five galaxies was a decorative plant of some sort. When it addressed her, she jumped slightly. The plant spoke perfect anglic. Gaylet took in the rounded, bulbous foliage, lined with silvery bits, which tinkled gently as it moved. The brown trunk led down to knobby rootlets that were mobile, allowing the creature to move in a slow, awkward shuffle. A contin, she realized.
Of course, the Institute's provided a librarian.
The vegesentient contin were old friends of Earth. Individual contin had advised the Terrigan's Council since the early days after contact, helping the wolfling humans weave their way through the complex, tricky jungle of galactic politics and win their original status as patrons of an independent clan. Nevertheless, Gaylet restrained her initial surge of hope. She reminded herself that those who entered the service of the great galactic institutes were supposed to forsake all prior loyalties, even to their own lines, in favor of a holier mission. Impartiality was the best she could hope for here.
Yes, she said, remembering to bow. I want to look up information on uplift ceremonies.
The little bell-like things, probably the being's sensory apparatus, made a chiming that almost sounded amused.
That is a very broad topic, miss.
She had expected that response, and was ready with an answer. Still, it was unnerving talking with an intelligent being without anything even faintly resembling a face. I'll start with a simple overview, then, if you please.
Very well, miss. Station 22 is formatted for use by humans and neo-chimpanzees. Please go there and make yourself comfortable. Just follow the blue line.
She turned and saw a shimmering hologram take form next to her. The blue trail seemed to hang in space, leading around the dais and on toward a far corner of the chamber.
Thank you,
she said quietly. As she followed the guide trail, she imagined she heard sleigh bells behind her. Station 22 was like a friendly, familiar song. A chair and desk and beanbag sat next to a standard hollow console. There were even well-known versions of data wells and styluses, all neatly arranged on a rack. She sat at the desk, gratefully. Gaylet had been afraid she would have to stand stilt-wise, craning her neck to use a goobrew study station. As it was, she felt nervous. Gaylet hopped slightly as the display came alight with a slight pop. Anglic text filled the central space. Please ask for adjustments orally. Requested remedial survey will begin at your signal.
Remedial survey, Gaylet muttered.
But yet it would be best to begin at the simplest level. Not only would it guarantee that she had not forgotten some vital fundamental, but it would tell her what the galactics themselves considered most basic.
Proceed,
she said. The side displays came alight with pictures, displaying images of faces, the faces of other beings on worlds far away in both space and time. When nature brings forth a new pre-sentient race, all galactic society rejoices, for it is then that the adventure of uplift is about to begin. Soon the old patterns reasserted themselves. Gaylet swam easily into the flow of information, drinking from the font of knowledge. Her data well filled with notes and cross-references. Soon she lost all sense of the passage of time. Food appeared on the desktop without Gaylet ever becoming aware of how it arrived. A nearby enclosure took care of her other needs, when nature's call grew too insistent to ignore. During some periods of galactic history, uplift ceremonies have been almost purely ceremonial. Patron species have been responsible for declaring their client suitable and their word was simply accepted that their charges were ready. There have been other epochs, however, in which the role of the Uplift Institute has been much stronger, such as during the Samubulum meritocracy, when the entire process was under direct institution supervision in all cases. The present era falls somewhere in between these extremes, featuring patron responsibility, but with medium to extensive institute involvement. The latter participation has increased since a rash of uplift failures 40,000 to 60,000 GYUs ago resulted in several severe and embarrassing ecological holocausts. Reference Galkahesh Burrali, Sistin, Muhern 8. GYU equals Galactic Year Unit, approximately 14 Earth months. Today, the patron of a client cannot vouch alone for its client's development. It must allow close observation by the client's stage consort and by the Uplift Institute. Uplift ceremonies are now more than perfunctory celebrations. They serve two other major purposes. First, they allow representatives from the client race to be tested under rigorous and stressful circumstances, to satisfy the Institute that the race is ready to assume the rights and duties appropriate to the next stage. Also, the ceremony allows the client race an opportunity to choose a new consort for the subsequent stage, to watch over it, and, if necessary, to intercede on its behalf. The criteria used in testing depend upon the level of development the client race has reached. Among other important factors are phagocyty type, carnivore, herbivore, autophagic or ergogenic, modality of movement, bipedal or quadrupedal walker, amphibious, roller, or sessile, mental technique, associative, extrapolative, intuitive, holographic, or nullitative. Slowly she worked her way through the remedial stuff. It was fairly heavy plodding. This library branch would need some new translation routines if the Chim on the Street in Port Helena was going to be able to use the vast storehouse of knowledge. Assuming Joe and Jane Chim ever got the opportunity. Nevertheless, it was a wonderful edifice, far, far greater than the miserable little branch they'd had before. And unlike back at La Paz, there was not the perpetual hustle and bustle of hundreds, thousands of frantic users waving priority slips and arguing over access time slots. Gaylet felt as if she could just sink into this place for months, years, drinking and drinking knowledge until it leaked out through her very pores. For instance, here was a reference to how special arrangements were made to allow uplift among machine cultures. And there was one brief, tantalizing paragraph about a race of hydrogen breathers, which had seceded from that mysterious parallel civilization and actually applied for membership in Galactic Society. She ached to follow that and many other fascinating leads, but Gaylet knew she simply did not have the time. She had to concentrate on the rules regarding bipedal, warm-blooded, omnivorous Stage 2 clients with mixed mental faculties, and even that made for a daunting reading list.